Hello, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news from the week beginning 22nd of April. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story concerns the so-called 996 ethos, the idea that employees work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. The benefits of hard work with little room for personal or family time have been extolled by Jack Ma, China's richest man and head of the Alibaba Empire. Although saying that he would never force anyone to work these hours, Jack Ma makes it clear that working such hours are critical to success. He is reported as telling his staff that being able to work 996 is a huge blessing, and goes on to say that if you want to join Alibaba, you need to be prepared to work 12 hours a day. Otherwise, why even bother joining? Not surprisingly, this statement has sparked heated debate on Chinese social media about what bosses should expect of staff. But although acknowledging the criticism following his comments, Jack Ma doubled down on his stance, saying that, well, if you find a job you like, the 996 problem does not exist. Kate, I would like to ask you if Ma's outlook stems from some unique cultural circumstances, or is it a frank and honest assessment of what happens when people find jobs that they love?
I think it's both, to be honest. And we do know from the work of Hofstede and others that different societies, different cultures have a higher or lower tolerance of hierarchy. And certainly, if you do find a job that you love, it's not like working. And I think many of us have had that experience. The problem to me here is about recognition and reward. If you're expecting people to work for you the way they would as owners, as Jack Ma is, are you rewarding them in a similar fashion? Or are you just expecting too much from them in return for not enough recognition or reward? And I think that to me is the important question.
Well, as a follow-up to that, Kate, do you think it's actually dangerous to advocate this type of approach to working hours?
I think it, to a large extent, depends on your view of work-life balance. If you think the way to achieve balance is to have strict compartments, so you allocate certain amount of time for work, for leisure, for family, for health activities, then this is obviously not going to do anybody any good. If you feel that actually working hard is invigorating in some ways because you really are doing something that you love and it's energizing, as long as you are taking good care of yourself, who are we to legislate at an individual level as to how people get energy from their work or how much enjoyment they get from them? I think it's being mindful of the individuals are different, and that as an employer, we have a duty of care to make sure, help them to manage their working lives well and not put unfair, unnecessary and unhealthy demands on them.
Okay, thank you, Kate. If we go on to our second story, it's about the ethics of non-disclosure agreements in UK universities. Figures sourced by the BBC through Freedom of Information requests show that since 2017, UK universities have spent almost £90 million on staff payoffs made under non-disclosure agreements, commonly known as NDAs. In a report on the human cost behind that expenditure, BBC News highlights the experience of an academic named under the alias Amy, who was urged to sign an NDA with her former institution and then leave after bringing a bullying complaint against one of her academic colleagues. However, since taking that course of action, Amy says the accused man has followed her to her new workplace and maintained a pattern of behaviour that has now lasted for 6 years. Speaking to the BBC, Amy said, "Because of the NDA, I can't tell people what went on in the past. I can't tell them why he's doing this." And she feels that, to quote, universities would rather pay off people to leave than push out the person doing the bullying. In a 17th of April response to the report, Universities UK noted that it will publish comprehensive guidance for universities on sexual misconduct later this year, which will cover the use of confidentiality clauses. Kate, I know that NDAs have been controversial for a number of years now, so when is an NDA actually appropriate?
Well, it certainly isn't an appropriate solution when it's being used instead of dealing with things that might be endemic sexual harassment or bullying. And as so often with these cases, there's invariably a power dynamic. There might be a senior academic who is behaving inappropriately, might have a great reputation, might deliver great research ranking results. And a junior academic or a student, in terms of the reputation of the university, is not as important, sadly. And therefore, the needs of the university and the ensuing negative PR. So you can understand to some extent why these are attractive. But of course, what they're not doing is protecting weaker and more vulnerable members of staff and students and dealing with the behaviour. So I think in the circumstances where an NDA is appropriate will be very few and far between and will never be the answer when you're actually trying to cover up wrong behaviour on the part of other members of the institution. Having worked in the university sector myself, I know they are used quite extensively, often as a solution to restructuring, not dealing with difficult problems. And hopefully this report, and certainly the response that's received, will shine a light on this, which is essentially poor practice.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Our final story concerns the recently published Harvard Business Review article, Five Myths About Strategy, by Stephen Bungay, director of the Ashridge Strategic Management Centre in London. This myth that was the most striking to me is Stephen's analysis that strategy is about the long term. Stephen suggests that it is precisely when long-held assumptions about an industry are challenged that strategic changes happen. Strategy, argues, is not about the short term or the long term, but about the fundamentals of how the business works, the sources of value creation, the drivers of the cost to deliver it, and the basis of competition. To get a grip on strategy, we do not need to lengthen the time horizon of our thinking, but its depth. Far from being about things we are going to do in the future, strategy is about what we are going to do now in order to shape the future of our advantage. I would like to ask you, Kate, what do you feel about that? Is Stephen correct? Is it a myth that strategy is about the long term?
I think this is such an eloquent way of describing how strategy needs to change, our view of strategy, our understanding, certainly our teaching of it in business schools, to reflect the environment in which we are creating strategies for. I think it's been too easy for too long to say something strategic, it's long term and therefore not really worthy of our immediate attention. And I think perhaps that's why so often we find ourselves over engaging with operations at the expense of strategy, or there being a big disconnect between the two. I remember speaking to some venture capitalists 20 years ago, and they were saying when they're looking at business ideas to invest in, it's not so much the idea that persuades them, it's the people. And if they are people who are able to respond to the idea not going well, not flourishing, and adapt and come up with a new idea, they're the people they want to invest in. And I think this is what Stephen Bungay is saying really here. It's about a mindset. It's a readiness to adapt to changing external circumstances. And of course, one of the ways of doing that is A, recognizing that that's what you're doing, but always being horizon scanning, looking out, making sure that people are being developed and being kept up to date, because that's what's going to really deliver competitive advantage.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the news and views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.